to this final session of the entire AFM conference. It's both an honour and indeed, I have to say, a certain poison chalice to be the person again given the equivalent of the last slot. Nonetheless, I think it's been a marvellous conference. I think we've had some very exciting and interesting times. I do believe that all of our digital systems, including the one that transgresses our translator, is working, so therefore I'm quite happy. Thank you for the thumbs up. It's good to know that at this stage, after 2 days, everything seems to be operating and functioning smoothly, even for this last session. It was fascinating to go and visit the floor of the exchange. I must admit I was particularly impressed by the beautiful leather sofas at one side of the floor. I don't think they would have ever been a success in any of the London exchanges, as there would have been too many traders trying to get extra sleep to make up for the deprivations of the previous evening. I think it's a great achievement to Buenos Aires that you can manage to maintain everything in such a pristine and organised fashion within the organisation. Very brief housekeeping point before I go any further. Thank you to everybody who's given me feedback so far on the Exchange Manifesto. It's been very, very helpful. We have had a couple of interest from a couple of extra sponsors, which is very useful for the AFM. I hope they'll come through. We've had already a couple of discussions with people who are looking to take the core of the book and translate it into their own languages for use in their own countries, which I think is absolutely part of the core rationale and reason why Christie originally was so keen to put together such a book. So anyway, we're still open for feedback, no matter what it is. I'll be delighted to do so, and I hope that we'll hear more from you in that respect. Now, this afternoon's topic is one about which I must admit I am truly passionate, ladies and gentlemen. The whole concept of product development, it's been with us, obviously, since as long as we've been having markets and been looking for something to trade on them. At the same time, it's fair to say that there's almost nothing new under the sun. In the same way that the Alfa Romeo Motor Car Company developed this revolutionary, for want of a better term, twin-spark technology in the 1980s for their cars, which had in fact been originally used on Alfa Romeos in 1908, so too, the world of product development is an intriguing one. When I was in the vanguard of reintroducing single stock futures, a lot of people were talking about how it was that I was in the vanguard of introducing single stock futures. Yet it's quite clear that on the Amsterdam Exchange, tragically I think Alan's not here to take that plaudit, on the Amsterdam Exchange during the course of the 16th and 17th century, it was quite obvious that there were effectively deliverable operations of a future on a single stock. And you can find that from the magnificent book by José de la Vega, Confusión de Confusiones, which was published around that time. And I must admit it's also fascinating because when you read that book, written 300 years ago, you see incredible portraits of floor traders. And what's more remarkable is that even this afternoon we were able to see the very self-same people. And nay, I think if we were to go into detail and read that book, we would probably find that some of those people who were shouting their orders out today are almost identical to those people that were on the floor several hundred years ago. However, nowadays, with the invention and the development of electronic trading technology, we, ladies and gentlemen, are at the golden age of product development. I've talked about it several times. There's a white paper on my website about this, which I used as a theme for a couple of keynote speeches I gave last year. And truly, this is the time where the possibility to develop any form of product is available. It ranges from the most simple, and in many ways they're the most important, base commodities. The more that governments manage to lose the nasty, inefficient subsidy habit and allow people to actually trade things on a market basis, the better that it is, obviously, for product development. Right through to the highly sophisticated nature of different products in relation to very, very complex financial instruments. We have today a very interesting question. We have today a very interesting panel. I am delighted to have here four very, I think, respected people in the world of product development. To my right, there's a man who I think at this stage in this conference needs no introduction. So thank you for being here, Rod Gravel at Blondin. There is a gentleman just to my right, Richard Hu, who I've known for well over a decade now. Richard's been with the Singapore Exchange and more recently joins us this particular week from the Taiwan Exchange. Just to my left, Bill Olsen, Norwegian surname, fairly interesting mixed immigrant parentage, as one would expect of someone in the United States of America, including indeed some Welsh blood, so we won't discuss rugby. Bill was formerly a sales executive with the Swedes, quite a brave move for the son of Norwegians, and he was dealing for OMX as an executive with them, and more recently he's joined Trayport, who I know have been represented this conference for several years now by different people. And then we have, well, in many ways the commodities exchange that started it all off in the modern era. 1848, ladies and gentlemen, time of revolutions virtually across Europe. It's interesting, now we have Champions League soccer to sort of keep us going for half the year. In those days it seemed to be revolution, seemed to be the opiate of the people. Presumably there was a breakdown of negotiation over TV rights somewhere around the Austrian Revolution in 1848, which therefore caused the whole system to fall apart. Bill, Richard Jelinek is representing the Chicago Board of Trade. It was founded originally in 1848. Very useless statistic for you all. 1848 is the last year in which the main part of the continent of Western Europe last suffered a widespread food blight and food shortage due to the failure of the crops. That's how long ago we're talking about the foundation of this market. It is indeed just slightly older than the Bolsa de Cerealis, which we were delighted to visit this afternoon. Itself a remarkable piece of history. Now, the question which has been put up for us today is, are new emerging products feasible for emerging exchanges? Do you know what, ladies and gentlemen? The answer to that question is yes. Now, does anyone on the panel wish to disagree with that? Good. Because, you see, the thing is, ladies and gentlemen, actually, when we were talking the other day, I mean, Hamdi Bagchi, for instance, has flown in briefly into this event, and it was great to see him while he's in the middle of a global roadshow introducing single stock futures in Turkey. And in fact, it's fascinating because when you look at a product such as single stock futures, there's a product where actually it's the established, the supposedly rich West that's actually done pretty miserably badly at it. The countries that are trading the most are in fact Russia, India, and presumably also we'll see an explosion in growth in Turkey. The United States, European market as represented by the MEF, which remains pretty much the most successful, and also Euronext Life, have been somewhat secondary. Richard, you've had quite a lot of experience developing equity products. Where do you think then the future lies in terms of emerging equity product?
Looking, let's say, in the past 20 years or so, I think the equities space of product development has certainly evolved a lot. Just bring to you some of the previous experience. Let me just relate to you some experience in Singapore, then I relate the experience in Taiwan to see the, where we can go from here. Okay. In 1985, Singapore listed the first index product that is not Singapore index, but the Japanese stock index futures. That's Nikkei 225 index futures. It is the first time where actually a foreign exchange in our own home country, listing the stock index futures of another exchange. I think that actually being the experience of new product development in this equity space. Then come also this, for the first time, Singapore also listed a non exchange developed index, which is the MSCI Taiwan Index Futures, which is also has been very successful. So that is the Singapore experience. Whereas also in Taiwan, we also have very successful index options contract. And I think in terms of, let's say, comparing with other part of the world, Taiwan has a very unique experience in developing sectoral index. I believe at the moment, Taiwan has the most active or most successful sectoral index futures, which is the electronic sector futures. I believe there are not many places have a liquid sectoral futures. So I can share with you that, yes, this is the experience that I can see. And I think that also support the notion that emerging products can be and feasible to be developed in these emerging markets. Of course, also going forward, also the lies with other difficulties in other product space. For example, in Taiwan, we also looking at this some of the more exotic products like DRAM futures, you know, the manufactured products. Can we develop that? Can it be successful? We do not know. But we do know that there's a lot of difficulties to be addressed, to be resolved. Just like the other day, I was talking to our friends from South Africa Exchange. DRAM futures be like this, or wine futures. You know, it's a big demand. A lot of people interested in certain things. But when it comes to delivery, there could be an issue. There's something that we have to face with. Coming back to your question on this equity side, I think the market is becoming more and more common, and every country, every economy are developing their own index futures. I think that going forward, sectoral index future is a space that I think will be of interest. Of course, single stock futures, single stock options are also is already developing very well. I think sectoral futures is probably a possibility. Thank you.
It's a fascinating issue you bring up. I mean, the whole concept of DRAM, dynamic RAM chips in computers, as opposed to DRAM, which is the currency of the United Arab Emirates, or at least of Dubai. So it, therefore, possibly one of the limits to growth may be actually how many things we can possibly have names for that don't sound like something else at this stage. But it does bring us a fascinating issue of the limits to growth. I mean, Rod, you obviously work, you've been responsible for creating the commodities marketplace in South Africa. You've been very strongly involved. You're a member of the executive committee of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, which obviously is a very, very successful stock exchange in its own right in Africa. Are there any limits to what can be commoditized and created as a product, do you think?
No, I don't think there are any limits, but I think there's two questions. You correctly asked in your opening remarks, Patrick, the first question, are there any limits? In other words, why not? But I think the second question that you have to ask is why? Why do you want them? There has to be, in my view, a reason. Now, I'm a commodity man, as you know. I'm not a horse racing man. And I think, with apologies to our translator, and a play on the word weather, because I think weather derivatives is mentioned, whether you have them or not depends on whether there's a need for them. I think this whole idea, a lot of, well, let's talk weather derivatives or new products, I think they're very sexy. But then again, you know, there's more to life than sex. Not much more, but there is more to life. So I come down to what is the reason you want them? Do they add value? You mentioned that I sit on the JSE executive. Yes, we had a very, very interesting discussion on the whole area, which is close to your heart, I know, Patrick, of sports betting. Should sports betting be part of an exchange, or is there a gray, a fine line between them? So my question is, why not develop products? Well, if they can be developed, you can practically trade anything. But the question that I have as a dyed-in-the-wool commodities man is why do you want them? Do you want them purely for speculative purposes, or do you want them to actually play a role? I believe that you need to have a reason for the development of a product, and I would like to see that reason based in the need to manage risk and not necessarily just to speculate to make money.
I think that's a brilliant point, Rod. In fact, there's two things really pleased me about this discussion so far. The first thing is For the past decade, I've been always the person who's been standing up proposing sports, event and related markets. Now at least we've managed to get the debate into the mainstream sufficiently that someone else raises it before I do. Leaving aside the fact that I think that our translator has suffered enough during the course of the last couple of days, and he thought he only had another 45 minutes to 1 hour to go before the end of the afternoon before attempting to translate your deft syllogisms, for which my compliments. Speculation and risk transfer, yes, they are the basis of markets. Although, interestingly, I'm going to come back to the sports issue in a moment because I just want to actually throw the original question to Richard Jelinek as well. Richard.
I would have run a book that you were going to come back to that.
Well, there you go. Was that going to be risk transfer or just pure speculation is the question. Richard, what are the limits to what can actually be created in terms of a tradable market?
I personally don't think there should be any limitations. To put limitations on product development is going to constrain the creativity. And as I mentioned in my earlier remarks today, that is very important. One of the most important things in developing markets is to keep that creativity, keep developing new ideas. New ideas can come from within the marketplace or they could come outside. But bottom line, wherever they are originated, wherever these ideas are originated, it has to be there for the customer, the potential customer. And when I'm talking about customers, I'm talking about the commercial side, the hedging side. You know, yes, we need the speculative interest to make those markets efficient. I will never go against that theory. But the bottom line, the need has to come from the customers, the commercial side, the physical side.
Now, Bill, you deal with customers. You deal with them in a slightly different fashion. You're selling them software. But you've seen some really quite interesting product developments in the course of the last few years, particularly, I would have said, via Trayport. What do you think are the limits to product development?
Personally, I haven't really seen any limitation. Personally, I haven't seen any limitation. I think, especially in some of the larger exchanges, they've been quite innovative in some of their products. I think it's now transporting itself over to the emerging markets, specifically in weather and emissions. I think that's an industry or a segment of the futures industry that is ready to explode, and that there's plenty of room to adapt emissions and or weather hand in hand with the agriculture and with the power markets to help normalize some of the risk inherent when you're trying to generate power and provide product, such as in agriculture.
So in that respect, what about the issue, and I think I'll come back to Rod here first of all, what about the issue of moral hazard in relation? I mean, we've touched upon it with sports, and certainly, I mean, sports have been discussed by established exchanges for more than a decade now. There were away weekends where the Life Exchange discussed it, the old DTB discussed it in the late 1990s. Actually, sorry, that's not true. It wasn't Life who discussed it. It was Paris Bourse Matif who discussed it in the late 1990s because the rugby mad Pascal Samara wanted to introduce sports futures. What about the whole issue, moral hazard, getting into something that is perhaps viewed as being either dodgy, devious, and illegal? I mean, obviously, there's probably quite a large amount of demand potentially for, say, drug futures, but it's somewhat difficult to introduce, say, forward cocaine. Apart from the fact that there's a quality issue, I believe, but that's only things I've heard by third-party experience, naturally. The whole issue of moral hazard, are there products that exchanges cannot offer because it endangers their reputation?
I think they are. It's a fine line because if you're dealing with financial products, I guess there's very little difference in betting whether the Dow is going to reach a certain level or not, or taking out a future or an option on that. That's a very fine line. But I think there are other products where, yes, and I was hoping you weren't going to ask me this question, Patrick. I think that perhaps it's more in perception and reputational risk, perhaps, that should an exchange who, I guess, needs to maintain a moral high ground in any way be involved in a product which could be seen as a little bit dodgy? So I think it's quite a perception issue rather than, you know, can it be developed, can it be traded? If you name it, you can trade it. But I think it's a perception issue.
It strikes me that there's a very fine line of degree. There is one quite interesting website, to put it mildly, if you want to go and look at it. I first read about it in the Financial Times. It's called adultwork.com, and it essentially serves as a bulletin board offering the exchange of sexual services at a price. It's effectively, to all intents and purposes, no different to a stock exchange. It just happens to involve something which I think certainly would be far too much of a moral hazard for any of the exchanges represented within AFM. Richard, how do you view it from the Asian perspective? What's the sort of issue with moral hazard there?
Okay, now I share with you the experience I see in Taiwan. Before we can launch a contract, we have to justify ourselves the economic value of such a contract. I think in order to launch, let's say, a sports contract or whatever, I think it would be very difficult for us to justify ourselves and justify to our regulators that there is economic value in that. Of course, no, having said all this, I think one day, let's say, this become a demand in some other places, then our view, our regulators' view, maybe changed then. But at this moment, I think it's a little bit dodgy. I guess, in my personal opinion, it's difficult to have such a contract in the Asian exchanges. Mm-hmm.
Patrick, one question to you, seeing you obviously search the web quite diligently. This website you mentioned, is this a cash-settled or a physically settled contract?
I think the answer is it's cash-settled with physical delivery. although I must admit, I do have a habit of, where I can find interesting exchanges, of trying a transaction just to see what goes on. So far, this is one which, for some reason, I haven't attempted upon. But, Richard, I mean, when you look at the whole issue of moral hazard and you look at what you can base, I'm brought back here, actually, to the history of your very own exchange. I mean, 30 years ago, obviously, there were large numbers of commodity traders who regarded it as sheer anathema that you could have a futures product that was either deliverable against a piece of paper, albeit a piece of paper owned by the or issued by the American government, or even worse in the case of what those people did across town. I mean, they were delivering things that they weren't even deliverable. You just swapped cash at the end of it. Do you think that the marketplace has moved on very, very significantly in terms of product development, or do you think that those sorts of old ideas, old biases still remain?
I'm going to change the answer to the first question. I do think there are limitations, and there should be limitations. I guess I am from the old school. By definition of a successful market, you need a homogeneous product, one that can be standardized, one with limited government intervention. So things such as drugs, gambling, I don't think it should be any part of our industry. But with regards to your second, your point about trying something new, the Board of Trade, up until recent times, was a membership organization. And as such, with all due respect to my many bosses, the members, in some cases, they were a hindrance to the growth of our markets. And just to point out a couple examples, which you're stating, it's the financial markets. They basically laughed at financial markets when they were first coming out, kind of pushed them aside. You know, the futures industry came from agriculture. Agriculture is always going to be the main part. And now somebody wants to create a futures contract on money and the price of money. How outrageous. Fast forward 20, 30 years, and now they're roughly 85% of the Board of Trade's volume. Other areas that I would say is interesting is the evolution of options. Options came about, commodity options, modern-day commodity options. We used to trade privileges, which were banned by our government in the 1930s, very similar to what we know as options. They started trading in the 1980s in the U.S. First, because of that original ban, they were limited to the financial markets, and then in a couple years later, in 84, to the agricultural markets. Again, the same membership who were concerned about financial futures, saying, why do we need these? We're saying the same thing about options, but a little stronger. They were totally against options because they felt, how dare you, as an employee of this exchange, come up with this concept to start trading options? You're going to take the business away from the futures. Again, fast forward 20, 23 years, and you can see how that they did not take any business away from the futures, but actually both markets grew. And then the last example, very recent times, electronic trading at the same time as open auction. How dare you even think of that? Well, we had it approved and enacted last August 1st, and as such, similar with the option story, the pit volume has grown as well as the electronic volume.
And in fact, I think that's an absolutely brilliant example for the AFM audience because, I mean, we've had so much discussion of this, and in fact, Gustavo Piccolo was saying this morning, the results of win-win thinking will take us to much greater things. And it is quite funny that the sheer whims of humanity have always tended to be to try and control things. As the Economist famously said, investment banks are not good at dealing with change. And we do have a remarkably closed attitude towards change. The US stockbrokers fought the concept of fixed commissions in the 1970s, and yet within 10 years they were richer and doing more business than they'd ever done in the history of society before. That's a very, very curious business, the whole idea of trying to unlock markets. Now, Bill, I mean, in many ways, Trayport's business, you do everything. I mean, you work with existing marketplaces such as One Chicago, providing new services for them, right through to dealing in all sorts of new product exchanges. You've got markets in fish, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So really what that comment that I led into from you was that the products are becoming so innovative and so instrument agnostic that just about any type of instrument can be listed on in technology. Getting back to your I just wanted to make a comment regarding the morality of the software vendors out there. I think as a group, we take a stance that the moral high ground is the best ground to be in because we have to maintain our integrity for our customers like yourselves. So getting into betting or some of the other organizations that maybe Patrick had mentioned are things that we certainly would not get ourselves into. That was true of OMX, that was true of Trayport, and I'm sure it's true of others. So, the vendors respect the establishment that we serve, and it would be something that would be against what we consider the moral high ground.
That's a very exciting statement, and I don't agree with it remotely, actually. There are now something like 27 different vendors supporting sports trading equipment. So I actually would take issue with you. I think I can understand that all those of us who want to visit the United States of America and not end up coming home with a souvenir orange jumpsuit in 25 years' time when they let us leave... probably do want to measure what we say somewhat. But nonetheless, I actually don't agree with you. I think if you look at the business of sports exchanges, I would actually turn it on its head. I think that exchanges need to think about whether they can afford not to be in the business of... There's a terrible word for this, ladies and gentlemen. Somebody in America has come up with the idea that sports events and politics and related markets are called prediction markets. And that's a very sort of, I don't know if I can say so, very North American concept, because I wasn't really sure that the rest of us had all been in the business of trading the past. So I don't quite know why they use the phrase prediction market. But, you know, when you look at that whole business segment, I'll give you a couple of bold statistics. Betfair is the biggest sports exchange in the world. It's come from nothing 6 or 7 years ago. It was founded around the same time as several other exchanges, and it's become absolutely the granddaddy of them all. It's a marvelous business. The London Stock Exchange transacts 50,000 bargains a day and takes 3 days to settle them, and has about 2,500 issues. The Betfair Exchange has something like 5,000 active markets, including about 250 active markets that are listed every day and about 250 that expire every day. It transacts 5 million transactions on an average day and settles everything 15 minutes after the close of that event. And I think, moreover, if you were to take Betfair at its current post-money valuation and float it as an exchange tomorrow, it would be somewhere between the 8th and 10th biggest publicly quoted exchange in the world. Which leads me to wonder just how long exchanges can manage to hold on to the moral high ground when they see large amounts of money disappearing out the door. Richard.
Okay. I just throw an analogy from here. I think at the moment you can take a look for this one, so-called sports. The market has already so-called the OTC exchange, like the bookmakers, right, in London. I'm sure you can. There are many of them already actively in the market, providing prices. So for the exchange to go in, first of all, they have to compete with such, you know, OTC players. Just like in the case of currency market, you have a very huge market, very big market. When the exchange try to get business, let's say, take business away from these OTC players, find it extremely hard, if at all possible. So while the market may be big, but for the exchange to come in to try to steal business from the existing player, I think it'd be really a challenge. Forget about this moral high ground or whatsoever. It's still a challenge.
And isn't it brilliant, ladies and gentlemen, we've managed to go via horse racing to the core of the debate, OTC via exchanges. Richard, that's an excellent segue. Thank you very much. I'm going to move from one Richard to another. OTC versus exchange. What are the ways in which exchanges, both in the existing established world and in the emerging world, can really manage to make a difference over and above product that's already traded OTC?
One of the key benefits of an exchange-traded product over the OTC is the financial integrity. And that is one way that the Board of Trade has looked to capture some of the business from the OTC market. And one of the areas I mentioned briefly earlier this morning, the new energy contract, the ethanol contract. A lot of the business in that industry is conducted via the OTC market, the ethanol swaps. And recently we entered developed a concept where we are not trading these products as futures contracts, but we are doing the clearing of these products, adding the financial integrity aspect to a practice that is very common in that industry.
Very good point. And in fact, Bill, I mean, you're in a position where you're providing not necessarily just in emerging economies, but to very much emerging exchanges. To go back to the example, I think is it called Fishpool, the marketplace in salmon. What are the benefits that they find both in terms of an established platform, and how do they go, those sorts of markets go about clearing, and is there a way to particularly bring them into the mainstream faster?
I guess it really depends upon interest and where people see the risk associated with trading salmon. Generally speaking, I would say that salmon probably has a shelf life of less than a week. But the interest is there that if they take the risk associated with fishing or trawling for salmon in the northern Atlantic, and the fishermen are taking a risk every day by going out there and fishing. If they don't catch something, then it's a problem. But in terms of making the liquidity for that market, it offloads that risk to the fishermen, much like the agricultural industry as well. So having a cleared instrument adds credibility to that market and makes that fungible product be able to trade in a much more liquid market.
Fish, salmon, liquidity, fungibility. We owe this translator a drink panel after this event. We really do. I must admit, I mean, I agree with you. It's very interesting when you're dealing, obviously, with a perishable product. And, of course, in London, I mean, there's also been some problems with the impurities provided by polonium-210 in the salmon recently, which caused a bit of a problem in certain aspects of the sushi market. But when you're looking at the whole project, I mean, OTC versus exchange, Rod, how do you see that developing in terms of the OTC or in terms of the emerging market space?
I would come back to weather, not W-E-A-T-H-E-R, but the W-H-E-T-H-E-R. Whether the exchange adds value. When an exchange stops adding value or coming down to economic terms, when it becomes too expensive to trade over an exchange, then you will go across to OTC. So to me, it's pretty much an economic thing. It comes down to the value add. We really putting in a hard push in South Africa to bring OTC contracts onto the exchange. And one of our newest products that we've launched, not on the agricultural side, but in the financial side, is what I guess is called in many parts of the world flex options. We call them can-do options. And really where the exchange adds value to it is to provide, to value it, and to manage the risk in it. And if that can be done economically, well, then you can bring it onto the exchange.
And therefore, of course, that brings us to the fascinating issue of how do we actually do that? I mean, how do we actually go and find these products? Obviously, there's the sort of Cinderella approach. You go out and kiss lots of frogs and hope that some of them turn into ravishing princes. There's the possibility of just waiting until those products come to you. There's the possibility of trying to develop your own products. But actually, I mean, Richard, I mean, drawing on your own experiences, long time at the Chicago Board of Trade, it's fair to say that some of the best products that have actually occurred in established markets have almost occurred semi by accident. Isn't that true?
You got me stumped there.
Well, okay.
I don't think anything is going to come by accident, but how things come about, as I mentioned earlier, it can come from anywhere. The ethanol industry is just a change in the fundamentals in the market and politics in the world, society in general, the need for additional sources of energy. So by pure chance, all of a sudden we have this new market, ethanol, and how it has impacted so many other markets. It's not just the ethanol market, but anyone who knew or knows anything about corn, and you could have been in the corn market for 20, 30 years, all the fundamentals you knew at one time, you just throw those out the window because now it's a whole new ball game, a whole new set of fundamentals. So one new market has impacted our grain markets, it affected the sugar markets, it affects the energy markets in a variety of ways. The one area that I would say in regarding the new products, it doesn't always have to be something totally out of left field. It could be something very obvious. All markets have two different types of price level, two different types of market risk. And you got the price level, and then you got the basis level. So in my opinion, there are exchanges that have already established themselves as the global benchmark, if you will. But that doesn't mean there is not a need for regional markets, local markets throughout the world. And I made these comments earlier, so a little bit of a repetition here. But developing markets need to focus on their existing markets to make them as efficient as possible, financially strong, financial integrity. And if you do that, it's going to open up the eyes of many of these global markets to the point where they're going to want to be involved, not to take over, but to be involved, just like the other comments I made earlier, where both working on their own behalf are going to make the whole better. The concept, Gustavo and I talked quite a bit about this, the concept of basis, tying these world markets all together, tying all these regional markets to that global benchmark, being able to manage the basis level risk. I think it is a concept that's going to be the next generation of products in our industry.
Just to take up something, I mean, you're talking about the global benchmark. just to be clear, do you mean that effectively you see that a global benchmark will be created that will allow one big exchange to possibly hoover up a lot of different developmental contracts, or do you still see that the developing world and the emerging markets can manage to have multiple contracts in their own local area that may be more fungible or spreadable against, say, larger global benchmarks?
No, I did not mean it in the way that you're saying that we, as a global market, you're just going to suck up all the new products. No, I meant as a market is established, it could be a very large, mature exchange. It could be a new developing exchange that has the greatest idea. And everyone looks to that market. Everyone accepts that market as the most efficient pricing of that particular product, a market with financial integrity. So it could be a brand new exchange that comes up with a whole new idea, and that is where the world looks to for the pricing of that product. And then you have the regional markets all over the world that need to be tied to that.
Okay, that's all right. That's what I thought you meant, but I just wanted to be absolutely clear in terms of the fact that it wasn't certainly a statement of American imperialism. The last thing we need is another gringo go-home invitation at this stage in what has otherwise been such a good and well-mannered convention. In terms of providing the technology, in terms of creating the technology for those sorts of new product, is there any sort of finite issue to what is difficult to create or what is difficult to produce for a new market product, Bill?
Well, I've had the advantage of joining a company that had a product that was built for the OTC market, and the OTC market is varied, through all spectrums, all different asset classes. I don't really see, and this might seem a little bit elementary in my point of view, any sort of limitation to being able to list any type of instrument on technology. In fact, to your point, Richard, linking together exchanges, linking together pools of liquidity, utilizing your clearing systems, it seems to be the way that a lot of the OTC markets are moving, and certainly a lot of the ways that the consolidation in the market of exchanges is headed as well, to reduce cost. So I think the exchanges are becoming smart, more nimble, and thinking ahead of their own survival. But the OTC market seems to be converging within the same market. For instance, in some cases, we have solutions out there where the OTC market is doing bilateral trading with credit risk, and they're also doing cleared trades at the same time. So there's definitely a mix going on, a hybrid market going on right now. And I'm curious to see who's going to win.
An interesting concept, and obviously one which we know we've been discussing already. I remember Alan was mentioning it on one of the panels yesterday in relation to the ABC initiatives on your next life and so on and so forth. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got about 347,000 things to discuss before dinner, so we are going to keep this panel running just for a few minutes longer, but I do want to give you the opportunity, as those of you who've managed to come back from our splendidly interesting trip to the floor, and perhaps you've got some comments or questions you'd like to address before I start giving the panel the once-over again. Chip Dempsey. Chip Dempsey, who I might add, claimed a conflict of interest and couldn't make it on this panel earlier, but he's now going to give us a profound insight, which is very, very welcome, Chip.
It's a question. But I'll preface it just with three things. One is, it's my understanding that the CFTC's requirements for a contract be that it either addresses an economic risk to be hedged or that it creates a valuable price discovery. So if you accept that premise, then the second premise would be that that there's interest in the level of security in the United States. When you go through an airport, you hear them talking about how the code orange of the national security or terrorist alert. And then the final is piece of information about prediction markets, which is that I think it was DARPA, which is a defense sort of fund for exploratory technologies, proposed at one point a terror exchange, which would be the likelihood of a terrorist event in the United States in some period of time, for some maturity, if you will. And given that 9/11 certainly had economic ramifications, one would think that that would have some sort of economic risk associated with it. So with those three disclaimers, hopefully shutting a couple doors, what would each of your exchanges or businesses view as the moral hazard or attractiveness of a terror contract, the likelihood of a terror event?
Richard, would you like to start?
I personally believe that to be successful, you need a market that cannot be manipulated. And obviously, there will be too much manipulation in that type of market, too many vehicles, too many parties that could have a direct impact on that. Probably a better way to go is something that has been looked at is in the form of insurance products.
Can I just let the panel all respond, and then I'll give you a follow-up, Chip, if that's all right. Okay. Richard.
I thought that insider information would be an issue for those people, especially for the terrorists. Yeah.
Yeah, the most interesting possibility could be that the CIA actually watches who owns what account. They might find out more than anything else. It could be interesting. Bill?
I'd have to talk to my CEO on that one. No, I'm only kidding. I don't think that it would be very likely that a vendor, especially for this audience, would be interested in doing something like that unless, I guess, the vendor, one of our customers, really wanted it. But I don't think that we would go out and try and start with an exchange, an emerging market exchange in terrorism, and do something like that. I think it would be extremely politically incorrect.
Ooh, political correctness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's another topic for dinner probably this evening.
I'm an American.
Perhaps if the lady can give the microphone back to Chip, and I'll ask Rod to quickly have his comments on that.
My comments are ditto to Richard on my far left.
Whoa, and the microphone arrives with Chip. That's seamless straight-through processing for you, ladies and gentlemen. Chip.
So my follow-up, I think you actually addressed. You certainly would have the ability, as any exchange does now, with large trader reporting, and knowing who's participating, of knowing sort of what accounts, and you could certainly have the expiry date be 6 months before delivery date if you're worried about anybody actually benefiting by their advanced knowledge. And if somebody was to express their advanced knowledge, would that not, understanding that they may not actually ever collect on their prediction or on the position that they took, would that not be valuable? And I'm not sure what would be politically incorrect about that. I would think that would be information that the authorities would be dying to get. I mean, they go through our email looking for one-tenth that amount of information.
Well, I have to admit, being a passionate European, I've got really no concept of the politically correct movement as it stands in America, so I have no intention of going down that route. But I think it was an interesting question. Having personally been long of fall of Baghdad futures for the end of whatever month it was on trade sports, I mean, it's an interesting concept to trade. And I suppose the only problem I can perhaps see coming up with this sort of DARPA issue was for me was that for the real insiders to get there, how are they going to pass know your client registration? That's the only thing I can sort of see. You know, we're going to have now this Mr. So-and-so from Al-Qaeda, and he's got his Sudanese passport is 6 years out of date, and he doesn't seem to have actually been anywhere for the last 4.5 years. And does he have an electricity bill for this cave in Afghanistan? Because, I mean, unless he can produce that, we really can't open an account for him. Could be an issue. You just never know. But actually, seriously, Chip, you touched on some quite interesting issues, and obviously regulation is one, and I think it's quite interesting that, I mean, we're obviously in the southern half of a continent which has the world's largest economy in it. But yet it also happens to be the world's largest economy, which for many of our eyes operates under remarkable protectionism. And I mean, one such is the fact that you do actually have to go to the regulator in order to allow them to let you list your contract, something which for, you know, the vaguely wheeling and dealing Irish people or the those who are dealing in London or Switzerland and so on find somewhat abstract. I mean, Richard Jelinek, do you think that it is better to have a central regulator in an emerging market, not the USA, that has a say over what products can be introduced, or is it better to let exchanges and marketplaces have their head in emerging marketplaces and decide what products to create?
I think the concept of a centralized regulator is good, but I would add to that by saying with limitations. I do not think they should be controlling the products. I think that is for the individual markets. And as the CBOT has always been, we have always been a self-regulator with government oversight. I feel the same way about product development. Perhaps there should be some type of organization, association, government division that will monitor the type of products that are traded, but not to hinder the creativity.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to give that a title. I'm going to call that the South African Airways paradigm, which is going to be it's named after a the lady with the microphone, which you can pass to the gentleman there. Oh, he already has the microphone. Excellent. The South African Airways paradigm, named after a famous flight I took from Johannesburg to Australia some years ago, where the chief stewardess introduced to the flight and to us to the flight and said, "We are here on South African Airways as the crew to make your flight as pleasant as possible, and we will do anything to achieve that aim within limits." But when we come to regulation, I mean, I think it's quite curious. Paul Meyer, do you want to talk in relation to regulation, or do you have a question for a second? Otherwise, I'll let this.
Well, basically, I just had a follow-up question to Chip. One question would be how he would define the underlying of his contract. But I think that is also one of the problems that maybe should be addressed. There's a lot of interesting ideas for new contracts, but sometimes it's hard to create the underlying. I mean, one thing that is would be an ideal new product is insurance, but one of the problems is how to define it.
I think the interesting issue, isn't it, that actually the problem with insurance is that insurance companies are now actually finding themselves increasingly close to competing with structured products issuance, because the ability to create structured products is a hell of a lot cheaper than it is to manage to create insurance. And in fact, I think if there's a marketplace out there that's going to have a huge issue, that is the insurance business, which is used to very fat premiums and huge brokerage charges. And we look at the way that I wrote a white paper last year, which was about the whole concept of megatrends in finance, and we identified the DNA of marketplaces, the smallest issue, which we call the micro trade. And I think that's very important, because the micro trading infrastructure of electronic markets allows us to create any product of any complexity very, very easily. And in fact, going back to what we were discussing on your panel yesterday, Paul, I think there is a very interesting issue over the whole nature of being able to put together complex products and bespoke products, which are add-ons for the client via the exchange. And in fact, I mean, that's a very neat segue, thank you very much, because I am interested in the whole business of structured products. I'm interested as to how the panel believes that emerging exchanges can best capture the most flow from that business. Is it to be actually a listing agent of structured products themselves? Is it to leave the structured products open to being listed wherever, but providing the basic building blocks? South Africa, it's somewhere that's had a huge structured products business going for years and years, Rod Blunden. How do you look at this?
Well, having flown on South African Airways on numerous occasions and having enjoyed various levels of satisfaction, I think the latter. I think that the exchange should be open to the market to provide and I come back to I guess where I started, to provide the opportunity to add value to the structured product. Mm-hmm. And if it can do that at a reasonable cost, then that to me is the answer.
Richard, who?
I think looking at the structured product space, the exchange has some gap with the market. But I say some gap in the sense that the structured product space are very much tailor-made. You go to tailor to make the suit. Whereas the exchange provides those mass market products. So in this respect, the exchange basically providing building blocks to the structured product market space. It's basically, I think this is what is happening. For the exchange to develop this structured product, just like the closer one will be, for example, the flex options or those, you know, where you can provide more customized market. But the market size is much smaller as compared to those mass market products. Yeah.
Bill Olson, in terms of structured product provision, where do you think exchanges should be in the overall food chain?
I think they should leave it to the experts. And, you know, if it's a new and innovative product, there has to be a trailblazer out there. And, you know, technology will come along with them. But I think it takes a big education leap for your clients, for the members, to be able to trade such products too.
Well, that's interesting, and actually that's what I think I'm going to make that actually the final question for this afternoon, and I can feel both Richards are getting very restive trying to get into the battle of managing to answer this, and I think it's quite intriguing. You've said that we should leave that sort of product development to the experts, but we've already discussed OTC versus exchanges, and now what you seem to be saying is that in fact, therefore, the OTC market is that little bit more innovative, and actually they should be allowed to have a head start on innovating product, which ultimately we'll hope exchanges can commoditize.
Well, I think the OTC markets have been, in some cases, trailblazers in creating new product because there's less regulation. They can advertise directly to their clients, or traders directly. They have personal relationships with them. They take them out for drinking. I mean, it really is a social event. And word can get out very quickly in the OTC world due to regulation and due to personal relationships. So I think in the OTC world, certainly, I think in small niches, they would be able to launch it faster.
That's pretty fair. I mean, let's face it, the exchange world's full of shrinking valets like Rod, Alan von Griethuysen, Simona. I mean, they're not the sort of gregarious people who've ever been known to take people out for drinks or talk to them, certainly. I can fully appreciate that. You know, the world of exchanges full of these techno gurus that manage to deal from home with multiple doctorates. Richard, where do you feel on actually, I'm allowing you to answer sort of two questions at once, both the structured product innovation issue and, in fact, the more wider structured product issue.
Well, I definitely agree with Bill when he's saying the OTC market has more freedom, less restriction, less government intervention. But I think there is room for the standardized markets, the futures industry, to work cooperatively with the OTC products because obviously there is risk. There are benefits that exist in the futures that don't exist in the OTC. And I already stated the one example of clearing.
Richard, who?
Okay, I just want to add a few words on here. I think at the end of the day, we need to look at the value chain, whether it's exchange or the OTC market. For the exchange, I think value chain is more on providing cost-efficient, effective system for trading or for clearing. Whereas in the OTC market, also the structured product, the value chain is more on customization. So for the exchange to come into this space, unless we can actually provide a value change or add value to that service, if not, we are hard. I think one particular area that the exchange could or actually is adding value would be the OTC clearing, but not on trading. OTC clearing is an area that exchanges are actually working on, and I think there are some possibilities and develop this business further, in particular on the credit risk side.
Mm-hmm. Rod. a final word in relation to structured products and that whole issue, if you have one?
Yep.
Ladies and gentlemen, if we've managed to render Rod Blondin silent, I think this is an excellent moment at which to round up this particular panel. I thank you very much for the time that you've taken. I'd also like to very much thank our panelists. I think in certain respects this was somewhat of a thankless task in terms of trying to corral so many different types of product and discussions, and indeed at the risk of having to buy at least another drink for our wondrous interpreter, whether we're able to discuss the weather will of course be dependent on whether there's time on the next occasion. We didn't get as far as discussing emissions trading, apart from creating a considerable amount of hot air from the panel. We were unable to get so far as really discussing the whole issue of credit derivatives, which Richard Hu was touching upon in the last few minutes. And I think that just goes to show, ladies and gentlemen, that we really are in a revolutionary period, the golden era of product development. Nonetheless, we've had some very, very useful issues. Richard Hu started with one of those fascinating experiences when he was at Singapore, the creation of the Tokyo Nikkei 225 Index. An index future which I think it's not fair to say it was the most hostile issue that the Japanese finance ministry had ever undertaken since 1945 on Singaporean soil, when they came round to ear blast the Singapore Exchange management at one time when they wanted the product delisted. He's talked very interestingly about all sorts of curious concepts. The DRAM future, I think, is quite an intriguing issue. Sector index futures, we've looked at single stock futures and how they go. As Rod Gravelet Blondin said, are there any limits? No. The questions we're looking at is why not and why. We have, of course, had Rod's very erudite and useful pointers. He has shown us that there's not much more to life than sex. Presumably the rejoinder of the Adult Work website, a marketplace which I'm surprised that no one picked up on. I would have thought its limits to growth are the fact that it's very difficult to commoditize. However, we've looked at the whole issue of speculation, risk transfer, and indeed where is the customer, as Richard Jelinek has pointed out. And indeed, well, I agree with the statement Richard Jelinek originally made, and I think he's still right in that respect. He may think that there are moral hazards and areas into which we would not wish to go, but certainly to impose limits on product development thinking is certainly to constrain creativity in this business. We looked at the whole business of moral hazard, and I can't help but think that for me, the greatest example of moral hazard actually dates back some years to the bond market. At that stage, it became popular when largely bankrupt pop stars would try and gain some cash from collateral from their back catalogue. And we had issuers such as David Bowie issuing bonds which were linked to the sales of their record. I think it's a very, very little discussed issue of moral hazard. Because let's face it, I mean, say the mafia of a certain nation wanted to get their hands on a large quantity of the Bowie bonds. The best ways to make your final two dividend payments really rock and roll, for want of a better term, is obviously going to be shooting David Bowie. And I've always thought that was a little bit of a concern, but nonetheless one which, if it only justifies or gives us a clear concept of moral hazard, if nothing else, thankfully has so far failed to pass. Richard Hu emphasized the issue that we must justify the economic values of what goes on. We've discussed, or at least touched upon, and we weren't able to discuss it further, the whole issue of regulatory bans. They've actually taken place in every country. The birth of the Deutsche Terminbörse was held up for many years due to the dog's dinner of German regulation and German laws over gambling. And indeed also various products such as privileges, the forerunners of options, were effectively banned in the United States of America, amongst other nations throughout the world. We've looked at the whole concept, and I think, again, we go back to Gustavo's comment about win-win issues this morning, and certainly that has been one. Futures are not upon a product that is battling against options. Rather, everything in this business is essentially complementary. And therefore, in that respect, we should all remain somewhat instrument agnostic, as the eloquent phrase was rejoined to us. Richard Hu raised the whole business of OTC versus exchange trading. Bill Olson has talked about the issue of profitability for the exchanges. We've looked at how some products can somewhat randomly find themselves at the forefront of business development, such as ethanol, due to various political and other factors. I know, ladies and gentlemen, we haven't even had a chance to discuss the possibility for trading, surely that most fungible of all global commodities, water. The focus on existing market strength and integrity remains one that we must all deal with at all times. The creation of global benchmarks, exchanges becoming more cost, and indeed the whole OTC convergence issue, as was raised in Hybrid Markets by Bill Olson. DARPA and terror contracts were raised by Chip Dempsey. Some mention, I think, might have been made of sports contracts, but I can't quite recall. We talked about the whole issue and the whole aurora of market manipulation. We saw, as Rod described, the business of the exchange being viewed as a structured product enabling agent. Absolutely seamlessly, Richard Hu finished his sentence, providing the building blocks for the structured products market. Nevertheless, Bill Olson pointed out to us the innovation of the OTC business. And in that respect, I think that, well, Richard Jelinek said a very relevant and reasonable thing when he added to us the fact that the OTC market is much more free in order to innovate and create new products. But the boom is ultimately when we can manage to standardize those products and bring them to markets. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been the final product of what I feel has been a very, very successful conference. It's been certainly one where, in my admittedly not quite so extensive experience as, say, Rod or Christy of AFM conferences, but nonetheless dating back several years and several conferences, marked by, I feel, absolutely the finest gala night that we've yet enjoyed at the Tango last evening. It was quite, quite phenomenal. It only remains for me to say, well, I was trying to work out how to really bring in my concluding remarks, and in a certain respect, I ended up thinking about last night and the tango, and they were talking about Borges and his poems of the tango. And then I was reading this morning some issues to do with an essay that Borges wrote about the nothingness of personality. I obviously immediately managed to understand and assimilate myself with that one. Borges at one stage was talking about the fact that the self does not exist, and he basically used to say, yo no se yo. Basically, the self does not exist. I think, ladies and gentlemen, the issue for us at this conference is yo soy AFM. We are AFM. I am AFM. And I think that's something in the cooperative spirit of this business. It's an association which built itself on what was originally very much, I think, a Don Quixote-esque principle. We were looking at the concept of tilting at windmills as a group. Yet now we've managed to build ourselves into an enterprise that has critical mass. I think Gustavo Piccola said a magnificent thing this morning. He said, we have proven the fact that different cultures are no barrier to reach new grounds. And certainly in the film this morning we watched, I noticed that one of the final lines was, life will be much easier and time will fly by. Well, ladies and gentlemen, time has flown by in relation to the several years I've been involved with the AFM. I know from the many teary remarks that were made and the telephone calls that were made to Theo de Vries at 3 o'clock in the morning, Dutch time, by certain parties during the course of the last couple of days, that this is an enterprise, an organization with a great deal of spirit and heart. And therefore, it has been entirely appropriate that we should come to such a passionate, beautiful, wonderful city as Buenos Aires to celebrate our 10th anniversaries. To Chairman Mara, I think our thanks on behalf of all of us for what has been an absolutely marvellous occasion. I'm personally very actively considering coming back for that 100th anniversary party in October. I think it'll be a splendiferous event, and I really think that it's a wonderful thing to have seen the Bolsa de Cerealis, to see MATPA today. And ladies and gentlemen, it only goes finally for me to thank a couple of important people, those people who in many ways are omnipresent but also not known, whether it be our photographer, whether it be the ladies who've been carrying around the microphones so patiently, whether it be this long-suffering gentleman in the box who's been doing such an eloquent job of translation. And indeed, everyone else who's been associated with this conference, Viviana, obviously from MATPA, has done such a splendid job of coordination, Christy, the board of AFM, and everyone else. I think this has been a marvellous conference. We've achieved 10 years. Our goal for the next 10 years can only be to bring together greater prosperity, better markets, and the opportunity to improve life for everyone on every continent we touch. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time. My name has been Patrick Young. It has been a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
And one final housekeeping point, ladies and gentlemen. The Oxford Room, 7 p.m., drinks. We don't know if we'll have the translator with us at that stage, but in the bar in 5 minutes, we will have a cold beverage of your choice without a problem. 8 o'clock is dinner in La Posada, which is just a short walk from here. We'll be going directly from the cocktails in the Oxford Room. Thank you very much.